And welcome to another episode of Knights at the Round Table. It is your boy, Man Wheezy. And we are joined today by Dr. Tracy Kemble. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm chilling, you know. I'm a little tired. I'm a little sore because I've been doing two-a-day workouts now. Something that happens, which I'm sure, I don't know if you know, but, you know, the older I get, the harder it is to lose fat. And I'm just out here trying to not be fat. So I'm doing two-a-day workouts. I hit the gym at 6, work out for 2 hours. Then I'm in my pool like around midday doing another workout. It's a lot. It's a lot.
Ah, this human body of ours, you know. I was laughing the other day with a friend because I remember, and I'm 59, so I totally get like when you get older, it gets harder. But I remember being in my 20s and saying, oh, I think I need to lose 5 pounds to jump into this outfit tonight. And I could skip 2 meals and I would be 5 pounds lighter. And now it's like I wake up and I'm 5 pounds heavier for absolutely no logical reason. Oh,
and I'm about to be a dad and my wife keeps like giving me these scientific reasons why the dad bod is real. And I'm like, please don't send me this. Like, don't send me this stuff. Like, don't tell me that it is inevitable that my biology is going to pack on weight because I'm about to be a dad. So I'm fine in every way, but I'm so glad that you're on with us. Our Patreon member, Denise, you know, and this is like a good plug because if you guys didn't know, we have a Patreon that you guys can support us on a monthly basis. It's in, the link is in the description, and she's one of our VIPers, and you guys work together, right? In some fashion. Tell me what it is that you do, how you know Denise. Like, what's the backstory for those who don't know you?
Oh, my goodness. Well, the backstory. Well, let me tell the front story and then we'll lead into the backstory. And I'm sure, I think it's okay that I share this. So I run, I've been in the world of abuse recovery for over 30 years and specialize in a program that specializes in narcissistic abuse trauma. And I know Denise because Denise is one of my head facilitators. She's on the front line every week, getting women grounded when they're just feel like the earth has been pulled out from under their legs. And you know what a beautiful spirit she has. She has such a servant's heart and she's a leader and all those necessary things. And so she's our frontline person that helps us bring women back to stability again.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that's very specific. Narcissistic trauma is what you specialize in.
Narcissistic abuse trauma is what we specialize in.
So basically,
actually, no. We actually specialize in the journey to self-love.
Okay.
But what we deal with on a day in and day out basis is a condition that results when you don't have self-love, which is being attracted to people with this condition called narcissistic abuse.
Okay, so then fill us in on what are some of the traits of a narcissistic person so that those who are listening, which our main audience is female, they could identify it in someone they're interested in or they're with right now.
Yeah. You know what? I have to tell you that if you were to ask me that question, even 5 years ago, I would give you a different answer than I'm going to give you now. And the reason being is that when any of us think about this term narcissism, right, or a narcissist, we think of this very grandiose person that, you know, I say that the difference between a person that's healthy and has a balanced ego, let's say, versus somebody who has narcissism is that we learn to walk in self-love and they are a self-lover. So we always think about this person who is very grandiose, very full of themselves, physically prone to showing their bodies and things of that nature. Well, that's what we classically thought about as a narcissist, but research is now showing there's about 6 or 7 different types of narcissism, from a cerebral narcissist to an altruistic narcissist to a covert narcissist. So the general thing that you need to know about a narcissist is you're dealing with somebody who lacks empathy. Mm. And that when when you enter into a relationship with them, it is not a relationship where you fall in love with the person, that person falls in love with you. You fall in love with that person, and that person turns you into a fuel source to constantly keep their ego at a certain level.
What's interesting about this is that I have a friend who shall remain nameless, but she's dating this guy, right? And I was talking with her the other day, and she was like, yeah, you know, this guy invited me to go do, basically he travels a lot, and he invited her to go travel with him. And hey. I was like, okay. But I was like, you know, I'm quick to be like, what season are you in life? Like, are you in the you want to be free and you can go do stuff season? Are you in the you want to chase your dream season? And she's like, I'm going to chase my dream season. And I'm like, but that sounds like you're hopping onto his dream, which I'm not mad at if you're in the I want to be a supportive person season. But I know you, and you've been telling me you want to accomplish your thing. So how does that benefit you? And then her answer was, well, because he's going to help me do my thing while I'm out supporting his thing. And I was like, I've traveled before, and I know for damn sure that when I'm out doing my thing, I don't want to do anybody else's thing. I just want to accomplish my thing and be great at it. And then the conversation ended with, yeah, I guess that's true, because we haven't even gone out on a dinner date yet. And I'm like, what do you mean you haven't gone on a dinner date? She's like, well, we spend most of the time at his job. And I was like, wait, you've been dating this dude for a month and y'all haven't like gone out and gotten dinner? Nope. So you're telling me you think that on this traveling, he's going to totally hook you up and accomplish your dream, but he hasn't made time to take you to dinner? You're just in his world? And that's when I was like, bruh, this can't be healthy. Does that sound like somewhat of a narcissistic person?
That sounds like it's a relationship not starting out on the correct foot at minimum, because, you know, that's a mistake that so many women make. And some of it's culture that we're programmed that we're just supposed to abandon our whole life if Prince Charming comes along. But that is such an archaic way of thinking. And if somebody is asking you, if somebody is saying, hey, I want to spend time with you as long as you align yourself into my world.
Right.
That is a narcissistic trait.
That's what I mean. And look, I don't want to like crap on the dude, because it's like, I get it. He's in a place where it's like, he's going for it. I had that place. I had that moment where I broke up with the girl. Both of us just got signed. We were about to hit the road. In order to make it in music, it was like, you got to give your all, because it's just hard. So she just got signed. I just got signed. So we were like, you know what? This probably isn't the best timing. We should break up. That's not how this looks. So I was like, man, you know, I could commend him for being so dedicated. But at the same time, it's like, if you do offer yourself up or give yourself up in the name of love, which again, I'm not opposed to it. I just feel that somebody has to have invested something into you that you can stand on to be like, this is going to be a worthwhile gamble.
I agree. You know what? I really don't think, and I've spent a lifetime many times being at battle with what is love not, you know, having all the wrong teachings of it and wrong interpretations and having to, you know, reestablish the whole belief system on what love is. And where I stand today is that, you know, authentic love, it looks like this. It will be like this. Sometimes we'll be flying like this, and then we'll fly like this, and then we'll fly like this a little bit and whatnot. What love is not is this or this, you know, that there, you have to have a sense of separateness. Because my personal belief is that we are all here on our own individual journey. And for me personally, I believe that my existence in this world is, you know, to to use the passions of my heart as the expressions of the great I am. And the more passionate I am, the more I get out there and do life, it's my calling. And I believe that that's everybody's, and that authentic love rests when you are with somebody who encourages you to go out and be the best definition of yourself, encourages you to have a unique identity all to yourself. And that's not taking away from the institution of love and marriage at all. That actually makes you a stronger unit, because you have two strong pillars in this foundation of marriage, instead of one that's holding on to the other and the one that's carrying the other.
Now, do you think though that's a unique situation? Because this, it sounds like there's this, I feel it's like it's a culture war, right? Against what it means to be classically feminine, what it means to be classically masculine. And the woman that's like going for it all, then it's always they're intimidating to the classic male. And I'm like, I'm a little different, because I've always been attracted to a woman that's out there just getting it. Like, I'm just all about it. I'm a cheerleader. I'm like, let's go. But there is a lot of podcasts dedicated to this idea that it's like going out there and getting it as a woman is not a classic feminine trait. What do you think about that?
I live my life by something that's called divine order. And divine order is based in feminine energy. And I consider myself a strong person. I consider myself a go-getter in life. And I happen to love the masculine energy. I think that to be a true strong feminine, the archetype of what a feminine is, that what makes you even more feminine is that strong masculine. And it's like yin and yang. It creates a perfect circle. Mm-hmm. And I think that I'm old school in that I think that without apology, that it's great when everybody settles into kind of how we're naturally made. And it creates the balance. It's when, you know, people get in our head and say, I don't believe that, you know, the energy of the masculine feminine has anything to do with what we're allowed to do or not allowed to do. You know, there's no limitations on either side. And a lot of people don't understand, you know, what the difference of a masculine and a feminine energy is the number one characteristic of a feminine energy is a creator.
Right.
Our bodies by nature create, right? And so whenever anybody operates in their creative spirit, that's a feminine energy. The execution of it, that's a masculine energy.
Mm.
And so we have both. And so I happen to really appreciate the masculine and the feminine in balance.
Yeah, I agree. The balance is key. I always think that if you're not aware of the balance, or if you don't know that there is a balance based on the circumstances of your life, one or the other seems to settle in, at least what I see when it comes to women that are around me, based on if there's a man in the picture. If there's not, then you're almost forced into the situation of preferring or needing to lean into the masculine more, because you got to get stuff done. Like,
yeah,
there's no like I have a friend right now, single mom. She'd love to be creative, and it's what sparks her joy. She thrives in it. Literally does not have the bandwidth to be creative because she has to be mom and dad. So masculine is where she lives. How do you help someone in that situation? What's the advice there?
So the advice would be, you know, I would want to sit down and you got to hear a little bit about, or you have to listen to what their background is. And it's all about time management and mind management. That's what I think that it comes down to, is that I believe, not that that's an excuse, but with the proper time management, and sometimes, which is so difficult for women, which is a very masculine trait, they're afraid to ask for help.
Yes.
They're afraid
that is,
to say, yeah, help. I need an afternoon of sleeping. I need some meditation time. I need a massage. Can you please come help me and watch the kids for an hour? And a lot of people won't do that. I don't want to burden anybody, but you know, I just believe that we have to have that discipline. I used to be one who I was terrified to ask for help.
Why were you? Were you able to figure out why?
Yeah, I was terrified to ask for help because my environment growing up, then if I asked for help, it didn't help anyways. So
yeah.
So I just kind of learned that, you know, asking for help, it's a bunch of hogwash. That shouldn't work, you know. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get stuck doing it myself. And so I'd rather do it myself. So I became a very controlling person. And I could not relax to save my life because I had to constantly, you know, plan my next step and what's going to happen and have a plan A, B, and C. And I was this hyper vigilant planner for so long. And I think during that time, I lost a lot of my femininity because I was in just that masculine role. But the slight shift of testing the system of saying, what do you feel that you need? I mean, the first thing that all women need is more sleep. You know, I mean, that's the first thing that there's a Harvard study that came out and it studied sleep in women or actually the lack of sleep in women. And, you know, I just remember reading it. And what you saw was accident, health problem, accident, health problem, financial issues, you know, and they brought most of it back to the fact that women just need more sleep. And, you know, doing little things like so many women, they also have another female in their life who's playing mom and dad as well. Mm-hmm. And it could go both ways, right? These are the type of people that you connect with to say, you know what, I'm going to take all the kids and have a slumber party and you go sleep and take a hot bath and go get a massage and be alone with your thoughts and go paint and, you know, do things like that. We have a choice to abandon our creativity.
Yeah,
it is a choice. You said, you know, right before we started the show that you're up early in the morning now exercising and you're making these slots twice a day to self-care because you want a difference in your future, right? To maintain your sense of self-care. We all have that choice. And most of it for women, if you're out there listening and you're saying, how dare she say that? I'm telling you, if I went into your life and walked around your world, I would probably see lots of areas where you're not having boundaries. And if you start putting boundaries up on little things like people who call you and take too much of your time and energy, don't answer the phone. Just have every day of my life, I go into a silent zone with my phone. I don't want to be interrupted because it disrupts my creative thought.
Yeah.
That, you know, when you go home, it's a matter of living in mindlessness. Before you walk in the door, you know, make a decision. I'm not taking any phone calls tonight because now is the time with my kids. And the kids are restless. It's time for them to go to bed. Why? Because I need some of my alone time to regenerate. Because if you're not good, you're not showing up in the best definition of self. And that's not helping your kids. That's not helping your work. That's not helping anything if you're not at your full game.
And, you know, what's interesting is that sounds like the perfect dip of your toe into the masculine. It's saying there's a goal to be accomplished and my emotions cannot be the first thing that I consult when it comes to accomplishing the goal. It has to be the end result of the goal. So if it is sleep, then it does not matter what comes in between me and the sleep. I have to make a conscious decision to bulldoze through all of those emotional like barriers and accomplish sleep, knowing that that's going to feed the creative and the feminine, if I can just do that. But what I find it is that a lot of women, because they live in their emotions, there's always a good and just reason to not accomplish that thing, right? Yes. So when I talk about the single mom, I'm like, bruh, my sister raised my niece alone. And I was there for the first 6 months and I wanted to die. Like, I have all the most respect for single moms. So I almost feel like, man, I can't even say nothing to this person because I know how hard it is to be a single mom. Meaning like I've had a 6 month like voyeuristic view of it, right? And then I got out and I was like, how does she do it? You know? So I never want to belittle those reasons that you tell yourself in your mind why I don't have time to invest in what I really need to do. But it's almost like in spite of this emotion, like I have to be able to even be hard on myself. So you seem like someone who doesn't bullshit themselves a lot.
Me?
Yeah.
No.
You don't, right?
I used to. Yeah.
I feel like you tell myself
all sorts of stories.
Definitely gone past that now at this point.
Yeah. Life is too short. You know, I mean, whenever I would do things like say yes when I really wanted to say no, have ongoing conversations that rob me of hours and hours of my time and my day. And in 2 days, the same person would be calling me back after I gave him my heart and my soul and my advice and all these things that we women do. And they were still stuck at that same story that they were telling myself. And I realized that there were so many areas of my life that were robbing me of my time and robbing me of my peace of mind. And so I go through life now very aware of, you know, I have this technique that I do that throughout the day I check in with myself. And I just say, you know, how you doing, Trace? How you feeling? Or do you feel that you have two legs on the floor? You know, one brain in your head? Are you being congruent? Who you are on the outside is who you are on the inside. And I just check in with myself. And you know, I mean, again, I go back to the sleep thing because I'm a huge advocate. And I want to just, if I can drive one more point home about this, because I'm sure that some women are saying, how dare she say that, you know, first off, this study is the majority of bad decisions and accidents that women face is because they're sleep deprived. And you know, it's no different than drinking too much. Sure. It's basically the effect of what sleep deprivation does to you. And if you know, say I feel selfish, you know, taking time for myself at night. And I was with one of my mentors and people, colleagues that we throw things back and forth in life together. The subject of self-love came up and she was saying, there are so many things that I want to do with my life, but I have children and I have obligation and I have this and I have that. And I just feel really, really selfish doing it. And where we went on this conversation was really to reach a point of understanding from the bigger picture. And it's a concept that is hard to grab hold of, especially if we've had so many cultural regulations on us, that if we don't take the time to invest in ourselves every single day and deposit that love into ourselves, and if I sacrifice my life for you and sacrifice myself for that person in this situation and all these different things, what happens is I become a depleted person. And then I show up to the people that I claim that I love and I give them B or C Tracy.
Right.
Because I'm depleted. Is that really love if we do that? Is that really love if you're so exhausted that you're screaming at your kids?
Right. Yeah.
And most moms just say, I just want to be a great mom. That's what I just want that. And, you know, every mom feels like they have the failure card in some way. And this is normal. I think this is part of the definition of being a mom.
Yeah.
But that being said, I was really convicted by that. And I thought that is such a difficult thing a difficult discipline to start to implement. But I don't want to give the people that I love a B or C version.
Right.
I want to give them the A version. And for me to be the A version, I have to be self-caring.
Yeah.
I've got to take care of myself.
You know, let me ask you this then, bringing back narcissism. Is there common traits within... Okay, and two-part question. One, is it mainly women who hook up with narcissistic men?
No, narcissistic men are more popularly known.
Okay.
Because they're more visible, I would say, but there are millions of narcissistic women out there, and they cause just as much damage and chaos to the man. You also find women are more open to talk about things and men aren't. But no, it has no preferences of gender.
Okay. So then are there commonalities in personality traits that make someone more susceptible to getting with a narcissist?
Yeah, there is.
What are those?
There actually is. So, first off, that when you talk about the issue of narcissism, you're talking about a spectrum disorder. So it's not like being pregnant. It's not like you either are or you're not, that it's on a spectrum. And we all have what's called healthy narcissism. It's right here. And healthy narcissism is what we need. It's when our ego is strong and in balance, and it allows us to keep the good in and the bad out. That's a healthy narcissism. As it goes on up the scale, it then merges into narcissistic characteristics. And these are just very difficult people. Very selfish people, very, you know, my way people. As it continues to go up, it then goes into a personality disorder that is called narcissistic personality disorder. And these are very problematic people. If you spend time with somebody that has narcissistic personality disorder, you will feel like you're going to want to jump off the edge of the earth someday because they make you feel crazy. Mm. And then as it continues to go on up the scale, it then merges into antisocial personality disorder, which is sociopath and psychopath. And you just want to, you know, completely stay away from people like that. Well, I say all that because at the opposite end of the scale over here, there is something that is called self-love deficiency disorder. And this is a condition where most of the people come from trauma. They come from abandonment trauma. They come from some type of a childhood trauma, and they're lacking the elements, the basic foundations of self-love, which is self-honor, self-care, self-respect, taking up space without apology, you know, all the things that I had to learn. I didn't know what that was all about for many years. So what research shows now is that as it's on the same spectrum, that you're dealing with polar opposites, both the narcissist and the person who stays in the relationship, which to give it a name, is called a wounded empath. She's a feeler. He's a feeler in life. And that wounded empath, they're both rooted in trauma. You see, and so it's just the opposite side of the coin. And so energetically, they're just aligning. So there's two types of relationships that keep narcissism sustainable. There's the narcissist and the narcissist. And these are two people who they just feed off of each other's ego, and they raise kids that are so traumatized by the whole thing. And usually the only reason that they end up breaking up is that they fight over the mirror, you know, and they go on their own way.
I just think of two influencers, like two social media influencers. That's all I think about.
Yeah. And you can just see when you see a narcissist and a narcissist, they just literally are, it's like both of them are milkshakes and they're just drinking each other's, you know, personalities and fame and all that. So the other type which is a dangerous type of a relationship is when you have a narcissist with a self-deprecate. And it begins, a narcissist with a self-deprecate, which is somebody who has self-love deficiency disorder. And this is a very toxic relationship because it is built on this person staying low and worshiping the narcissist.
Yeah.
And the narcissist staying in control by keeping this person down, and it can go on for years and years and years and years.
Oh man. And that sounds like most abusive relationships, that right there. Mm-hmm. Like if you don't know what you're worth, and then you have somebody who knows exactly what they're worth or has an idea of what they think they're worth.
Yeah.
It's almost like in a dysfunctional way, I could see the self-deprecator almost admiring the narcissist.
They more than admire them, and because there's something going into the relationship that's called narcissistic conditioning. When you get pulled into a narcissistic relationship, it's no different, in my opinion, having done it, it's no different than getting onboarded onto a cult. that they lure you in with the love and the promises and the gifts and this lifestyle. And they do something called future faking, and they put you on a pedestal, and they know what your weaknesses are. And so they will paint these pictures to get you think like, oh my gosh, finally my prince or princess has come and everything's going to be wonderful. And they wear this false facade.
You said fake what? What was the word? Fake?
Future faking?
Future faking. I've never heard this. What's this? What's future faking?
Future
faking. Is this like somebody who's like, oh, I can see you as my wife. I can. Is that it? Because dudes always do that. Okay.
We're gonna travel the world, and we're gonna have beautiful babies, and I'm gonna give you this, and I'm gonna give you that, and then it never comes about, you know. And so yeah, future faking. So what happens is it can go on for as long as 2 years. And there's three phases to the narcissistic cycle. Phase one is I call it the dream boy and dream girl stage. And that's just when you meet this person and they put you up on a pedestal and you just have never been treated so good. And the sex has never been so good. And everything has just never been so amazing. And you think you found your one. And a lot of narcissists move really quick in a relationship. Because they have this 2-year mark that all of a sudden this fake facade is coming off. And when the mask begins to slip, they can't hold it inside. They can only do it for so long. And once the narcissist really feels like they have their target or their victim, whichever word you want to use, under their control, they then flip. And literally in one day, they will go from somebody who loved and adored you to somebody who abhors you.
Wow.
And then that clicks because of the self-love deficiency disorder and the deprecation personality, that all of a sudden the deprecant in the relationship will start to fight for the original relationship. And now you're getting the narcissist. The narcissist gets high when you worship them in the beginning and you think that they're so wonderful, and they get high thinking like, wow, everybody's impressed with who I'm with. Wow, that makes me a valuable person. And then when they get bored with that, because they're like little children, they have very high boredom levels, that they will suddenly switch, and all the laughter and joy that they brought you before will turn into tears and pain. And the worst thing about it, and the reason I'll just use it in that dialogue right now, get stuck in this cycle, is that they don't realize that every tear you cry when a narcissist hurts you fuels them. They actually get off on it because they say like, yeah, look how powerful I am to her. So that's why they have to continue to come back and hurt you and hurt you and hurt you, because they're getting fuel.
This sounds like a damn drug dealer who gives you a taste and then all of a sudden flips it on you once you're already hooked.
Yeah.
And I could see someone chasing that affirmation that they had before and even justifying the situation that they're, no matter how crappy it is, they're holding on to the memories of the good. And they're that to just sail on through the shitty waters of like horribleness, you know, like, oh my gosh, I can see this play out in so many relationships that I know that I'm like, I didn't know to call it this. I didn't know to say, oh, this seems like narcissistic tendencies. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. It just seemed like somebody who was glutton for punishment. What does it usually take for somebody to like get out of it? Like, is there a straw that breaks? Is there a word or a part of that? What's the third cycle? I'm assuming the third cycle is either like,
yeah, well, the second cycle is, the first cycle is the dream girl, the dream boy. The second cycle is the degradation cycle, where they go and they just start chipping away and breaking you down, because the goal of the narcissist is to get you to stay forever, because you are their primary fuel source. If you leave, they don't have fuel. And all narcissists have three fuel stations, as I call them. They have their primary, which is normally the person that they love and the person that they're with, that they can just, you know, pull. It's called a hurt to rescue, pull you up to push you down, pull you up to push you down, to pull you up. That can go on for years and years. The second level of fuel that a narcissist goes after, the secondary, it's like the flying monkeys and the fans of those of the narcissist, you know, the people who worship them. Oh my God, they're so wonderful. And they're not up close, but they just, you know, they believe their stories and whatnot. And then the third level that where the narcissist gets fuel is you see this a lot. People who are cashiers at a store, waiters or waitresses, people that they can just randomly yell at and go after and play that boss and scare people or flatter people and just get that quick little fix of, ooh, look how powerful I am. But the narcissist needs to keep their primary fuel source close to them. What happens is, like I said earlier, narcissists get super bored quickly. So they go through the dream girl, the dream phase, and they enter into the degradation phase. And after a while, they're just like, okay, well, now I'm just bored with, you know, constantly tearing this one down. I need to go find somebody who floats my boat more or that I can tear down. And so then the third phase is the discard phase. And a classic narcissistic indicator of a relationship is all of a sudden narcissists will leave, put their partner that they've had in their life out like trash, and go on with a whole new life.
Man, my friend dated a narcissist. We laugh about it now that we look back, because she was like ready to marry this dude. And this dude was like, this was his cycle. Like, it was all love and rainbows at the beginning. Then it was like he just kind of changed into some new person. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, I'm out. And we find out he's technically not divorced. He has another kid. He's like on to the next. And we're like, wait, what just happened? We think he was more sociopathic.
That's what happens is that they just leave their victim on splattered on the floor and in just a state of shock and debilitated because they have spent years, you know, breaking that person down and convincing that person that, you know, they can't breathe without the narcissist.
Oh my gosh. So first, I didn't ask you at the beginning, but A, are you married?
Yes.
Okay. B, when did it switch for you? What was the defining moment where you're like,
So mine came in phases.
Okay.
So the first thing that I want to clarify is people have often asked me, it's like, how did you end up as an adult with a narcissist? And the reason being is that I was raised in a family environment with a parent who was a narcissist. Mm. So I just thought that this is how people behave.
Yeah, it's normal.
It was just normal to me that, you know, adult temper tantrums and things like that, you know, I didn't like them, but I thought that, you know, well, I saw it my whole life. And so when I saw the people around me doing it, it was like, oh, there it is again. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like my orientation to it. So I remember my recovery, I was married once before, and my recovery kind of came in a phase that I reached great points of emotional pain that I didn't want to even be in this existence anymore. I remember I walked into the therapist office, and as this therapist does, you know, why are you here?
Yeah.
And the only thing that I could say, and this was years before narcissism was a popular word to use in recovery, that I said, my brain feels like it's made of mush, and I feel invisible. And I just lost all traction and hope in life. And I was just in a complete fog. And I was living in a hypervigilant state all the time. It became normal for me to, you know, wonder who's walking through the door today. Is it going to be Dr. Jekyll? Is it going to be Mr. Hyde? Is it going to be the person that puts me on a pedestal? Is it going to be the person that pushes me off the pedestal? And I just reached extreme points of emotional pain. And it was just, but my final symptoms were I couldn't think. And that's because, you know, one of the things that a narcissist does is they do what's called gaslighting. Mm-hmm. And gaslighting is when they try to distort your truth, that you'll say, no, I know that this happened. I know that this is wrong. And then they word salad you and, you know, use all these words to the point that your head's spinning even more, that nothing gets resolved. you know? And so it's just a buildup and a buildup and a buildup and a buildup. And I just reached a point that I was completely emotionally, I had just lost all traction in life.
And that was your first marriage.
Yeah. And it just, it was a long, hard road out. And, you know, I had several streams of influences that led me there that I had to untangle. I had to untangle my first trauma wounds, thinking that a narcissistic personality is normal. You know, I came from a very religious background, and in certain religions, there's a lot of narcissism in the teaching there.
Yeah.
You know? And so I had to, untangle all that. I had to untangle anything that I had allowed to take place in my remarriage to my real husband, mm-hmm. you know, that I had allowed mild behaviors, and that prompted his unhealthy behaviors. But luckily I had somebody who was willing to do the work, and that was a big thing, but it, you know, took a while to get there. But
your second husband, meaning the guy?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. How long in between the two?
Between
the first and
I think it was like 3 or 4 years in between the two.
Okay. I always tell people, mind you, I've never gone through it, but I'm always more of a supporter of people who end up getting divorced or whatever, because it's like, I feel like, and you can tell me if this is true or not, but I feel like if you ever get a second time around, like you're coming to the table with so much more wisdom on what you need to actually make it work. I feel like marriage number one, I mean, it's great. If you can make it work, awesome. But you're coming into it with a lot of like assumptions and a lot of like inclinations that you're like, this is what marriage is based on whatever societal norms you're in, cultural norms you're in. But then the reality hits you and you're like, oh crap, I shouldn't have been looking for cute. I should have been looking for character. I shouldn't have been looking for this. I should have been looking for that. So second time around, you're like, okay, blinders off. I know exactly what I need to make it work.
Right.
Did you feel that going into
Sure. You know, for sure. This, you know, little things like something that was important to me is just having the freedom to have an opinion.
Yeah.
You know, just, and if I have a different opinion than you, then allow that space. You know, because you cannot have an intimate relationship with somebody that wants to shape and mold you into who they need you to be. That's not love. That's narcissism.
Yeah. Man, that's crazy. I am so happy that I got to talk to you. I know you have to go, but it's like everything that you're saying, it's stuff that I see in people, and I acknowledge it and I say it. But the verbiage you're using, I'm like, oh, I've never said, like, I didn't know it was called that. So I'm so glad, because now I get to go back and be like, hey, you may want to look into this.
Well, you know what? I have to share that I just released my latest book, and it's called The Narctionary. Ooh. And it's a dictionary that has over 350 words and phrases that is for narcissism, narcissistic abuse, trauma, and narcissistic recovery. Mm. And I wrote the book, I dedicated it to my mom, because my mom raised me with this wonderful story or saying or what have you, that she would say that when we have something that's wrong with us and it doesn't have a name, it's like fighting a ghost, and that we can't grab a hold of it, we can't bring it into our life and mend it and hold it and love it back to wellness, or if it doesn't best serve us, to push it out of our life.
Right.
But when something has a name, we can grab a hold of that and say, what is this that I'm dealing with? And we can bring it into our life, and we can shape it and mold it and put the boundaries on it and put the repair into it. Or if it doesn't best serve us, we say, no, this doesn't work for my life. And so what Narctionary does is Narctionary gives name to the many ghosts of narcissism. And I decided to write it because it was probably like the book came together really, really fast. I decided to write it because I was talking to a very good friend of mine, and I saw for years and years that she was with a narcissist, and, you know, she went through the first cycle, and then the second cycle, she was kind of secretive and withdrew, which is another sign of somebody who's going through, through some stuff. If your friends all of a sudden withdraw, and then out of the blue, he slips into the third cycle, and he just discards her after 12 years of marriage.
Wow.
And she was devastated, and she was on the floor and didn't know, you know, which way. And she called me, and she's like, I know you've talked about this for years, but I think I'm with a narcissist and blah, 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 blah. And she would say, you know, it was just so frustrating because I, you know, he was this way one day and the next he was a completely different person. I said, yeah, his mask slipped. His what? His mask, the narcissistic mask slipped. And then, you know, I would do this and that and the other, and he would get so mad. And I said, well, you caused a narcissistic injury. A what? A narcissistic injury. What's that? Blah, 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 blah. And she's saying, and the most frustrating thing is that there's, you know, whenever we argue, there's no resolve. There's just like a lot of talking. And I said, yeah, he word salad you. What is word salad? Word salad is when they take a bunch of words and throw it in there just to confuse your mind. And so I just, the conversation kept going along these lines. Yeah. And then she said to me, you know, you should write a book, Tracy, that gives all of us newbies, you know, name to these many things that happen within the narcissistic relationship. And all I did was I said, oh, and I opened up my phone because I kept in my recovery, I had an alphabetized list of all the, wait a minute, with my therapist, wait, what? What is that called? What is gaslighting? What is a covert narcissist? What is, you know, blame shifting? What is all these different names? And people, as we're coming to the end of the interview, people often ask me, what is your favorite word or term in the book? And my favorite word or term in the book is a term that is called poop in your soup. And I really needed to learn about poop in my soup because I was a professional at tolerating the intolerable. And when I learned about this term called poop in your soup, it's a reminder that no matter how small the dose of narcissistic abuse is, it's like having poop in your soup, and poop in your soup is never okay.
It's not okay.
It's not okay.
It's not okay to have poop in your soup.
No poop in my soup.
Please.
What's one of your life?
Ladies, if you or men, anyone who's dealing with the possibility of a narcissist, please poop in your soup. No way.
No poop in your soup.
I'm so glad you mentioned that book, and I love Narctionary. Like, we'll put a link in the description so that people can find it. I'm seriously so glad we got to talk. I'm glad Denise brought you up because it's just very, very educational. And like, I love how much you know your stuff. And I also love and appreciate the time you took to really balance. Like, for anyone who knows about feminine and masculine energy, I can tell that, you know, I try to balance in it as well, because I'm super in touch with my feminine, totally good with my masculine, and I'm not afraid of either. But when you notice it in somebody else, it's like, oh, that person's done work, like for real work, because it's usually one or the other, very much so. So kudos to you and all that you're doing. Thank you for taking time. I appreciate you so much. I'm sure those who are going to hear it.
You. And thank you so much for bringing me on, and congratulations on this last season.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work, because the work is good.
We will. You too. Guys, we're going to leave all her information, her Instagram, everything in the description so you can go follow if you like what you heard. We truly appreciate it. Again, don't forget our Patreon. Don't forget that we got merch. I'm wearing our shirt right now that has our benediction in the back that you'll hear right now, which is, we pray you find a seat at the table. But if you don't, you are always welcome at ours. Cheers.